Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
We live in a time-spent economy. Things are competing for your time. And we obviously, you can always get more money, but you can't get more time. So time is the finite resource that we all share. And it's the ultimate neutral, flat leveling playing field that we all have to operate on. And if you have companies competing for that, you're going to end up with these problems. The line in the film that I think describes it best, that Justin Rosenstein says, who invented the like button, is so long as a whale is worth more dead than alive, and a tree is worth more as lumber than as a tree, and we don't regulate private forests or protect, state forests. Now we're the whale, we're the tree, we're the resource that is being strip mined into our cognition. And that means that we're worth more if we're addicted, distracted, outraged, narcissistic, attention-seeking, polarized, and disinformed than if we're a thriving citizen or a healthy, growing child who's, living their lives in the way that we want. And I think this speaks to some of your work, Andrew, because it's about dignity. It's about, are we the product where we're just a cog in the economy, or do we fundamentally have dignity? And can we have a system that treats each of us with the kind of sacred dignity that it should work that way?
Yeah, it's about, do we work for the economy or does the economy work for us? Are we worth more outrage than calm? It's like, well, maybe I'd still prefer to be calm, even if I'm worth more outraged. We have to see to it that we're not all just instruments of profit and revenue maximization, because it turns out maximizing our profitability is really bad for us. It means that we're very, very pissed off and ready to click and act and watch whatever videos you want to serve to us at any moment in time. Happy end of 2021. We're closing the year with one of my favorite conversations from this past year, Tristan Harris. You may know Tristan from The Social Dilemma on Netflix. He's the co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology and one of the foremost voices on why we should be very concerned about what big tech is doing to our brains. We'll be back next week with new interviews and our predictions for 2022. Hope this year ends great for you. And we'll see you very, very soon. Hope you enjoy my conversation with Tristan Harris, coming right now. It is my pleasure and thrill to welcome to Yang Speaks someone I consider a friend, but more than that, he's a hero of mine in terms of explaining to folks how technology is hurting us as well as helping us. Tristan Harris, welcome to Yang Speaks. Tristan.
Andrew, thank you so much for having me. It's great to see you again.
I'm going to keep singing your praises for a minute, Tristan. I'm going to keep singing your praises. Hi, God. Design ethicist, founder of the Center for Humane Technology. You might have seen him in what, in my mind, was a groundbreaking and award-winning documentary, The Social Dilemma, that's on Netflix. One of the most human people on earth. All right. Sorry, I'm going to do your introduction justice.
It's really great to be here, Andrew. I've always tell people, hopefully maybe we'll mention how we met, but it's been just amazing to see your really authentic rise from, what I thought were humble beginnings when we first met at the TED conference in 2017. And I'm just blown away by what you've been able to accomplish And anyway, we'll get into all of it, but I'm just as happy to be here with you.
Thank you. You and I met several times over the last number of years. There was TED, and then there was an event in New York where Arianna Huffington was there, and we reconnected. And then there was a house party in the Bay Area where I was like, hey, it's just out of the kitchen. And they're like, so it certainly felt like we were going to be working together in various ways. And there are so few people who really, there's only one of you. And I want, for people who don't know you that well, and I know you must be a little bit tired of relating your background and how you came to this, this cause and this organization. But you became kind of a singular voice of reason in Silicon Valley a number of years ago when you worked at Google.
Yeah. I mean, so my background, for those who don't know, I actually, just to tell a slightly different story that I think relates to your experience, I used to be into tech entrepreneurship. I had a small startup company. I was CEO of that company. It was called Apture. It was sort of a failure after 5 years. It got talent acquired by Google. But I know the startup game. I know the thing that people who are building engaging attention-driven applications face when you're an entrepreneur. And my friends in college, I studied computer science at Stanford and was part of a lab called the Stanford Persuasive Technology Lab. I studied there with the founders of Instagram, especially Mike Krieger, who I was project partners with, actually. And we originally were thinking of how we could apply persuasive technology for good, which is, you know, we had this professor, BJ Fogg, who would teach, you know, how do we apply the principles of persuasion to technology? And can we use it to help people live their dreams, live their goals? So work out more, floss more, whatever it would be. And Mike and I, the founder of Instagram, built something called Send the Sunshine, which was the idea that if you knew two phones and you knew one of them was in a zip code that, based on the weather forecast, had 5 days in a row of bad weather, the other phone was in a good zip code with good weather, it would send a text message to the person with good weather to say, hey, your friend Tristan has bad weather. Do you want to send him some sunshine? So this was using persuasive technology to orchestrate more, I don't know, love or compassion or kindness for other people. And so we saw those tools, but then overall, as things progressed, I saw how more and more of my really well-intentioned friends got trapped in this kind of venture capital-driven, viral growth, get maximum engagement, maximum time spent, and it became, as the phrase now is known, the race to the bottom of the brainstem, the race into the lizard brain, to try to get people using their products. And it was through seeing that and being at Google that I sort of said, something's wrong here. And I have to say first that Google was generous, and I think creating a space for me to do some of that research, where I became a design ethicist, thinking about how do you ethically steer and design people's attention when you're playing with some very deep-seated psychological vulnerabilities.
So you mean they didn't exactly hire you to be a design ethicist?
That's right. Yeah, I arrived at through a sort of the secondary success of this presentation that was sounding the alarm about how we were really kind of like the stewards, the moral stewards of the human collective consciousness, that 2 billion people's minds are running through the kind of wiring diagram of how we create the attention economy, you know, through our choices. Like, how does a notification work? How does a newsfeed work? How do app store payouts work? Do you get paid the more you send teenagers to hospitals for depression, or do you get paid based on, you know, subscription revenue, based on people feeling like they're getting value from something? So all of those mechanics were, you know, really part of how Google was positioned to kind of be a Federal Reserve of the attention economy, or kind of a government of the attention economy. But the critiques were obviously much larger than Google. It was really about how does this entire tech ecosystem work in the best interests of people, which is why I think it relates very much to your work. Like, how do we make these economic systems really work for people?
Yeah, I feel like you and I are tackling related problems of humanity that we are facing right now in 2020. I want to rewind a little bit further back, just because I find you to be such a fascinating figure. You grew up in the Bay Area to a single mom, is that right?
Yeah. Grew up in San Francisco and went to a small school for working parents. I grew up just with my mother, not with father. And then we went and moved up to Santa Rosa, to the countryside, to live out her dream of owning horses. And I had no one in my family who was interested in technology. I was the only one who was always on the computer and learning programming when I was about 15, and didn't anticipate anything that would be happening now, certainly.
So you're the geeky kid who's on the computer. You get into Stanford, which is not that far away, so I'm sure you're excited about it. You get there, and it sounds like you were working on technologies to try and do something positive. That Vijay Fogg Persuasive Technologies class is now legendary because it seems like half of the major tech entrepreneurs of the last generation all went through there. How was your time at Stanford, and did people have a sense even then of the magnitude of both the changes and the companies that would spring from it?
You know, when I was there, so I was there from 2002 to 2006. I should say I was including with the founders of Instagram and several other of my friends who were, really optimistic. We used to meet and wonder like what would be the ways that we would apply, our computer science degrees towards social impact. We used to gather every 3 weeks or so and sit in some hidden part of the Stanford campus and brainstorm, what those projects might look like. We supported each other. We all had really positive intentions. This is different. I didn't know the people who started Facebook, although I remember when Facebook landed on the Stanford campus when I was a sophomore in 2004. And we saw, the kind of arrival of photo tagging and the way that it sort of took over Stanford dorm room life. And that's actually what you see in the film, The Social Dilemma. How the features of photo tagging, which was this perfect sort of persuasive cocktail to keep people coming back to Facebook at that time, because it's basically tapping into, one of the most ancient kind of deep-seated human vulnerabilities, which is social approval. Hey, there's a photo, it's of you, and someone else tagged you in this photo. Don't you want to see, obviously, if it's a good photo or not? And when they found that feature and it worked, it's like, let's dial that up like crazy and have everybody uploading photos and tagging each other all day long. And I'm sure the productivity of the entire Stanford class dropped by, 20% or something like that. But we didn't really know, obviously, back then, any of this would lead to political polarization or mental health problems for kids or, shred apart, the fabric of our, information ecology and people believing in more conspiracies. These came about much later, I think, through people realizing where those incentives of maximizing engagement and attention would take us.
Well, you certainly had very positive intentions because of the nature of the company you founded out of Stanford, Aperture, and you were grinding away at that. So it seems like we may have something in common where I started a company that did not work out. I feel like your company came a lot closer to get to working out, in that certainly no one bought my little company to employ us in the way that Google bought your company. So can you tell us a little bit more about your entrepreneurial arc with Aperture? Because as someone who started a company myself, it was very, very hard. It sounds like you had some ups and downs too.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, I don't talk about this that much. So Aperture, just so I explain what it was, the phrase we came up with, it's like lighter fluid for sparks of curiosity. It was a service that when a publisher like The Economist or New York Times put it on their website, it would create this ability for a reader to get on-the-fly multimedia explanations about any topic. First started out as a publisher tool. So we had like the climate change blog on the New York Times and several other sites basically linking statistics or videos. So you would say, hey, I want to...
So how many of you were there? And did you get a little bit of funding out of Stanford, like when you decided to launch this thing?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was 22, I think, when we started the company. And I actually was living in Argentina, learning to dance tango, and on the evenings working on this startup from a cafe. We had a few Stanford friends of mine in senior year get together. We raised venture capital investing money from a couple fathers and friends of some other friends of mine from Stanford. And we got our first deal with the Washington Post. This is back in the heyday of people asking, what would the future of news and online context be? And the idea was, could we do something really different and radically new when it came to news online? In fact, it was about social impact. Like, for example, could you see the congressional voting record of every single politician while you were reading the New York Times and see the video that they gave of the speech that they gave on the House or Senate floor right there in the article without leaving the page. And we actually built that. So on the Washington Post for a few years in 2007, 2008, you could click on any Congress member and then see their voting record and videos of them on the House or Senate floor without even leaving that article. So we were really trying to create a kind of transparency and positive social impact and a reifying of what would make democracy stronger. Of course, and this is where the story turns, what happened was that publishers like The Economist or New York Times or Washington Post would ask us, okay, we thought we wanted you to help, you know, give people these interesting features to learn about whatever they want. It ultimately, our success metric for them was, did we increase the amount of time people spend on their website? And that's when it really hit me that my personal goal, which is more of a social impact, almost aesthetic or art-driven goal of, can we make, you know, democracy stronger or give people better information, was really a different thing than the business goal, which is about maximizing engagement and attention, even on news websites. And the fact that I couldn't reconcile that in my own mind, that every day I would kind of tell one story to our team of engineers. We were only about a 10-person company. We would tell one story to them of we're trying to make the world, you know, more curious and help people learn about things. But then there'd be this other side of it, which was measuring our success on how much time we were getting people to spend. And I tried to pretend for a long time that was the same thing, you know, just like at Facebook, like we're making the world more open and connected. Yes, we are doing that, but we're also maximizing just engagement. And they seem really aligned, right? If one is happening, like I'm making the world more open and connected, then the other thing should be happening. People are spending more time. So it's easy to fool yourself into thinking that they're the same thing. And, you know, I don't think I've actually told this story before, but it was through a set of other tech founders and I gathering for something we called Doubt Club that I decided to basically cave in and just, frankly, let Google acquire the company for parts because, you know, it was hard to admit to myself that really we weren't going to go anywhere and that this was something that we were going to be trapped in this attention game forever and there'd be a limit to the kind of growth that we could get because we had to fight for every publisher that used our service on their website. So we started a group called Doubt Club where several founders, you know, realizing that when you're a tech founder, you can't really express, you know, doubts.
It is a very isolating thing being a founder because you're there and it's like you're telling your team, hey, we're going around the corner and you tell the investors, hey, we're going around the corner. Like there's no one like there's no founder that's going to be like, hey, guys, I actually have my doubts about this. Because one of the things that happens is that any doubt you have gets amplified and magnified tenfold for like anyone around you. I'll tell you, running for president was like that too. It's like, you know, like if the candidate starts evincing doubts, people will be like, wait a minute, I'm dedicating my career to like trying to get this person elected. What? You know, so like you have to be freaking stoic and on top of it at all times.
Completely, right? I mean, and that's the pressure as you're talking about. I mean, in many leadership roles, you know, there's no safe place to sort of say, man, I'm not sure if this is really the right path, or maybe this business model isn't, maybe we shouldn't exist even, you know? Can you even think those thoughts, or are those thoughts unaffordable to you? So this group was really profound. We had several friends, and the first rule about Doubt Club is don't talk about Doubt Club because—
Definitely, you know, really, don't talk about Doubt Club.
Yeah, I mean, sure. We had to be, many of us, we knew each other's investors. And so if you're given a safe space to talk about, maybe this shouldn't exist, you know, you're not going to go off and you're going to keep that secret, obviously. So it was through that social support, though, that several of us ended up letting our companies become talent acquired. And what I mean by that really is acquired for parts. I mean, this was not a successful acquisition. And then another person in that group ended up just shutting down their organization and company. But again, I think what it really had us recognize is the internal conflicts and the kind of denial that we can face when we're sitting on top of something. You've raised millions of dollars, you've got 12 people working for you, you've got livelihoods that depend on you. Can you be really honest about when maybe the thing that got you here isn't what is really still happening, that social purpose? And that's when, you know, I think this started to turn for me. And I think that's what's at the root of when I look at many people in the tech industry. I don't see them as evil people. I see them as trapped by a set of incentives that I think now many of them also agree are true. And this is just kind of the place we find ourselves.
Yeah, you experienced the incentives directly on two levels with Apture. Number one is, how does my company grow and get paid? And that's related to how publishers grow and get paid. And that's time spent on their website so that they can sell more advertising. And then the second set of incentives is, if I'm in a leadership role in this organization, then what are my imperatives? What am I allowed to express and not express? And those two things are playing out at a gargantuan, almost unthinkable scale at a place like Facebook. Because for them, instead of being like, hey, I'm going to get an extra contract from a publisher, it's like, I'm going to get tens of billions of dollars if we just keep this thing going. And then if you're a senior executive at Facebook, you're like, okay, I've got the biggest franchise in the history of the world. Some people are telling me maybe I should examine my practices. Well, let's see. I have very, very powerful incentives, like pulling me this way and not really that way. So you lived it, and I think you understand it more deeply as a result.
Well, I think that's actually why, Andrew, I think our message, I want to name, there's many more researchers in the community who've been studying some of these problems, whether it's Doug Rushkoff or Sophia Nobel or others who focus on different aspects of these harms. And we're really building on the work of those people. But I think the reason that when our message came around, that it really resonated with people inside the tech industry is it spoke in the vocabulary and language that they actually operate in, which is, do you have a metrics dashboard? Do you measure DAUs, daily active users? Do you measure MAUs? Do you measure engagement time spent, 7-day actives? We know the common metrics and design decisions and the kind of vocabulary that people on the inside use. So I think when we spoke, it was the first time that I think people on the inside had to come to terms with the fundamental misalignment of incentives that I think people didn't want to look at. And I just want to name that because, you know, while I think we've been successful at that, we're building much on the insights of people who came before and have been critiquing these areas, whether it's Sherry Turkle or, you know, more recently, Gene Twenge and Jonathan Haidt. There's lots of great people who are doing the research, and they're also in the film. I think we've been successful because we've been speaking a language that makes it more universally understood for the masses. And that's why the film actually is so exciting, because I think having it received in 190 countries and in 30 languages, you know, being number one in India, number one in Lebanon recently, breaking records on for documentaries on Netflix, I think it's created a cultural moment, a global cultural awakening, akin to something like Inconvenient Truth or A Silent Spring, but for the toxic business models of some of the tech companies.
It's so important. I am so proud of you and whoever busted their tails trying to get that movie into the world, and Netflix for taking it up and distributing it. Thank you, Netflix. This podcast is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Going online without ExpressVPN is like changing while leaving your window wide open. You might not have anything to hide, but why give randos a chance to invade your privacy? When you go online without a VPN, ISPs can see every single website you visit, and they can legally sell this information without your consent to ad companies and big tech, who can then use your data to target you and profit, not to your benefit, generally at your expense. So using ExpressVPN, it's like being a member of a high-tech company that's on your side, where they beam you into a server in another part of the world. No one can see anything you do. Just fire up the app, click one button, and you're beamed onto a completely safe, anonymized internet. They can't do anything with your data. I use ExpressVPN to have that peace of mind. To secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/yang today. That's expressvpn.com/yang. And you can get an extra 3 months for free. expressvpn.com/yang. So you have this tough a series of meetings at Doubt Club, and you say, look, I think Apture is not going to stand the test of time or grow the way I want it to. So then to get yourself acqui-hired for parts by Google, is that like an easy thing? Because, you know, you're a hyper-talented guy. I'm sure some of your engineers are hyper-talented. Is it like pick up the phone? Did you have friends at Google where you were like, hey, like, let's get this conversation going? How does that work?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I had some friends who were at Google, but I didn't know any of the leadership there. Certainly, I think we were, you know what it was actually? I could tell you the story. Do you remember when Quora first launched?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so Adam D'Angelo, who's the CTO of Quora, had started this question and answer site, which everybody now knows is called Quora. And there was the early community of Quora adopters. And one of the first questions that I think it was Zuckerberg who asked the question on Quora. And it said, who are the most, sorry, I'm not trying to toot my own horn here. I'm just trying to give you a story of what happened. But Zuckerberg had posted, what are the most talented companies and people that in Silicon Valley right now that most people don't appreciate? And there's obviously lots of lots of answers to that post. But the one that people voted up the most was actually Apture and our team. And so I think that post, where we were highlighted as a uniquely talented group of people, led to some conversations about acquisitions with Google. I came to know Sundar Pichai, who at the time was, he's obviously now CEO of Google, but at the time he was head of Chrome and apps. And, we started an acquisition process with a small competition. It was very challenging. I mean, actually, these things take a long time, and it was really one of the most stressful and depressing periods of my life, to be honest, because you have to admit that, you've been working for 6 years incredibly hard, and it's all just, we got eaten up by the Borg. I mean, our entire service and all the publishers and all the code and all the data and everything we had done got, became ash once we got acquired. But I think it did teach me many valuable lessons, and I think it created the foundation for the design ethics work that took us to now.
So you get absorbed by Google. They put you on which team? Was it Gmail?
Yeah, they put us on the Chrome and Apps team, so we started working on some advanced, like, personal assistant type work. And then that led to working with the Gmail team. And I started I was working with the people who were designing the next version of Gmail. And, I found myself in the room with, the designers who manage this interface where people, you go to any internet cafe back before COVID, and you see almost every laptop has this like Gmail page open, right? I mean, almost everywhere.
Oh yeah, we all know it, sure.
We all know it. Like, people live in this space. It's a habitat. It's not just a product we use. It's a space we live and we work in. And given that importance, I thought to myself, as we're designing the next version of this, this is an opportunity to really think about how this is an enormous source of stress in people's lives, It's funny because I think one of the responses to the film, when I say in the film that I'm really addicted to my email, a lot of people don't understand that because email is sort of just junk mail for a lot of people. But coming from, I think, the generation that you came from and that I came from, email is a central place where, especially at the time, every now and then I would be getting, big introductions to people who would help us advance the work. So it became my own slot machine to check, did Daniel Kahneman, the head of, the founder of behavioral economics, email me and that kind of thing. But that said, I was thinking about, is Gmail really good for people? I was thinking about, this is a pretty addictive, stressful place in people's lives. Could we reduce social expectations? Could you make it so that when you send an email, you could say, hey, I actually don't need a response for 2 weeks. Could we start to implement features that would reduce the addictiveness? And, there I am in the room, and there's no other room in the world besides that Gmail design team room. And if
that
I thought
was
if
the
there
room.
Was the room where it happened, and I thought if there was any room where people would care about this, this would be the one. And I found, to no disparagement of my colleagues who were working at the time, I just didn't find the conversation really as thoughtful as it needed to be, given the consequences that we were having for like 6 hours or 4 hours of people's days.
So first, how many people were in that room?
Good question. I think probably somewhere between 6 to 10 people usually in those rooms.
Okay. How long were you at Google before this discussion is happening?
So within about 3 months, we had joined the Gmail team and we're starting to have those conversations. So pretty 3 to 4 months I was in there.
And then you sent out a now legendary deck around, hey, we should probably be thinking more deeply about the choices we're making because they're about to influence billions of people over time. Was that just months after you joined Google?
Yeah, that was in January of 1 year in. So it's basically 1 year into being at Google after trying to make it work with the Gmail team. I really wanted to see us ship something that would make a dramatic positive impact in people's mental health around email and stress and notifications and attention. And because it wasn't going anywhere, and because overall, like other apps, whether it was Quora or Path or all the, Instagram at the time, which was just, blowing up, I was just disappointed in where are we as a tech industry heading? Like, what, where have we lost our moral compass? Do we really care about what we're building and how it's impacting people? Or have we kind of forgotten, you know, that there's more to just capturing lots of attention and going, getting virality? And so I went on a trip to the Santa Cruz Mountains with my, one of my best friends, Asa Raskin, who, his father, Jeff Raskin, invented the Macintosh project at Apple. And that's where we get our name in Humane, for the Center for Humane Technology. Asa's father, Jeff, wrote a classic book called The Humane Interface, which is the foundation of some of our work. But Asa and I were in the Santa Cruz Mountains and, you know, connecting with nature and just being out there. And it just really struck me that I needed to go back and there needed to be something that was said about this. And it, the words came to me in that trip. And it was, never before in history have a handful of technology designers who mostly look like, you know, hipster engineers in San Francisco between 25, 35 years old, mostly men, mostly white, you know, making decisions on behalf of a billion people was the number at the time. Now it's 3 billion people, to show you the growth rate of how fast these things go. And the presentation included just a bunch of examples. You can actually find it online on minimizedistraction.com, I think is where someone had leaked it and posted it. But it used a bunch of examples of how technology's tapping into our psychological vulnerabilities and the cost that it was having on kids, on mental health. And it ended up going viral. I sent it to a few people for feedback. And instead of the 10 people I sent it to exclusively, I came to work the next day and I had like 100 emails about it. So I knew it had gone viral to many more people. And as the film The Social Dilemma says, you know, it went up to Larry Page's office in several different meetings that day. And I think it created a moment of reckoning where we actually said, hey, can we do something about this? And I would host follow-on lunches at Google, bringing people together from different teams to talk about it. But it was just hard to get a real coordinated action because the external global pressure from consumers or from the world or from governments just wasn't there. And that's what's astonishing, is to see where it is now, because compared to, you know, lunchroom meetings that I would book at a random part of the Google campus with, you know, 12 people showing up saying, how do we fix this? To today, where you have, I think, something like 30 to 40 million people are going to have seen this film very soon in 190 countries. It feels like it's taken 8 years to get to a point where we're going to be able to meaningfully change these incentives.
So this is 2012 that you send this deck out and then it goes viral at Google?
Yeah, 2012 to 2013, somewhere around there. Beginning, end of 2012, early 2013.
All right, let's call it early 2013 then. So when you send this deck out to your 10 contacts, were you concerned at all that this is going to make you seem like someone who is not on board with like the like the general direction of development of the project you're on? I mean, you're relatively new to the company. It's an enormous company, and the rest of it. Like, is there any concern that this is going to be bad for your career?
Yeah. I'm glad you're bringing this up because it's easy to skim past this now. I actually had no idea how people were going to respond. I was prepared that if I had gotten fired for some reason because of it, that I would be okay with that. So I had pre-committed that that was an okay thing, an okay outcome for me. And I was, you know, I was actually really afraid to send it out, which is why it was surprised me when so many people, when it shared virally. I mean, you know, on Google Slides, you can click on a presentation and it shows you in the top right-hand corner how many simultaneous viewers there are. And there was something like 150, and then later that day, like 400 simultaneous viewers, for, you know, in a 10,000, you know, whatever it was, 20,000 person company back then. So I did not expect to be, I'd never been in my life a person who went against the grain, who was highly disagreeable, who was trying to challenge things. I wasn't outspoken. It just struck me that no one was sufficiently paying attention to this, and it was too important not to.
So then it sounds like the feedback was by and large quite positive, so much so that they actually give you this new title and role saying, you're going to be our new design ethicist. You're going to tell us what's what. So how was that transition and role, and how long were you in that role?
Yeah, so this is important. There was a fellow at the Google Creative Lab in New York who had actually helped co-write, to make the story all circular. He helped co-write the first Macintosh, the famous Macintosh Super Bowl ad. If you remember the woman running down the streets and throwing the hammer and smashing the Big Brother screen. He had co-written that advertisement. He had seen this presentation at Google and was really impressed by it. We connected on this book that had really shaped him by Neil Postman called Amusing Ourselves to Death, which is really, I think, entirely descriptive of exactly everything that's going wrong right now, that culture and our society would surrender to the forces of technology, and technology would become start to subsume culture and remake culture in its image, and that we would be caught in this kind of race, not for attention, he didn't express it that way, but this race to make things amenable to how technology would want to see and shape the world. Metrics like, you know, in this case, he was talking about SAT scores and predictive analytics for college admissions and things like that. But he didn't at the time know about a few years later, we'd have tech companies running by the metrics of time spent in engagement. And that book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, opens with this description that we were all watching out for the year 1984, when the form of dystopia and tyranny in the form of Big Brother and the Orwellian vision of dystopia would come to, you know, subsume society. And then luckily it didn't come to pass. We made it through 1984 and that didn't happen. But he says that there was always this second vision of dystopia that was the more subtle one that people don't remember as much, which is Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, where the tyranny is not of restricting access to information or censoring what you can or can't think, but instead bludgeoning people with a sea of irrelevance, with so much narcissism and egoism and passivity and informational overwhelm that people wouldn't know what's true, and they'd be amusing themselves to death. And this was the book that this fellow at Google, who offered to host me to work on this problem, and I connected on, and then I started to become, I didn't know what to call it, so we just said, let's call it design ethics. And no one had ever thought, how do you ethically design along the social psychological vulnerabilities of humanity? And it became more of a research project for the first 2 years. And I tried changing various things within Google. We tried talking to the Android team and changing things on Chrome and how would we make smartphones work differently, and talk to the App Store teams about changing incentives. But I couldn't get anywhere. And so about 3 years later, I decided to leave. And soon after that, I was on the Sam Harris podcast, where you and I think both launched our careers in a certain sense. And
Sam Harris, thank you.
Thanks to Sam. That podcast was the kind of coming out moment for this work. And Chris Anderson, who runs TED, emailed me a few days later, which was, I think, only 3 days before the TED conference, and said, I need to get you to come to TED to do a TED talk on what you just shared on Sam's podcast. And I was actually about to fly to Czech Republic with my mother, who was dying at the time. And this was the last time that we were going to take a trip abroad. And I decided to go, but then cut my trip short. Go to TED, had 2 days to prepare this first TED talk on how technology controls a billion minds. And that's where I met you. And I remember the moment it happened at the, you know, the buffet table, I think on that Friday. That was, it's a long time ago now.
Well, I did not know what the run up was to, you know, for me, I was just blown away by your talk and was like, that was incredible. It's like, I didn't know about Sam, and certainly not, you know, you're abbreviating your trip with your mom.
This podcast is sponsored by Helix Sleep. I have always been a mattress guy. I thought if you're going to spend 8 hours doing something, you should pay attention to what you're doing it on. That's why I love the Helix Sleep product. It is made for me. I am someone who sleeps on my back. I do not sleep hot. I like a firm mattress. And so when I took the Helix Sleep quiz, I wound up with a Helix Dawn model. And it's been fantastic, not just for me, but for my kids who seek it out of the entire house. Don't want to take my word for it? Helix has been awarded the number one mattress pick by GQ and Wired magazine, and they have a 100-night free trial and 10 to 15 year warranties baked in. That's confidence in your product. And if you get on a Helix Sleep mattress, you will see why they are so confident. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and two free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/yang and use code HELIXPARTNER20. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now.
So when you decide to leave Google, here's the thing. Google, famous for its food, famous for all this stuff. You're hanging out there. You've got this design ethicist job and you're like, hey, Android, try and do something better. Hey, you know, like everyone, try and do something better. And you realize you're not making headway. I still feel like 99% of people would have been like, just stay there forever, do your thing, because you're in like corporate womb. Like, you know, people respect you. You're still in the mothership. So it feels like a big decision to be like, all right, this is not working. It's time for me to go. Particularly when you decided to leave, it didn't seem like it was clear what the next steps would be.
You know, it's so interesting, Andrew. I really appreciate you asking these questions. That's exactly right. It did not at all feel clear. You know, leave and go do what? Like, how you're inside of the biggest, most influential company in the world. That is probably one of the biggest surface areas for these problems showing up, which is all of Android, which actually has a majority of smartphone users around the world. In the US, obviously, it's more iPhone skewed. Why in the world would you leave that environment and obviously be paid? I think Nicholas Nassim Taleb wrote the line that the three most addictive things in the world are cocaine, heroin, and a monthly paycheck. It's very hard to walk away from, you know, monthly security, job security. And I really didn't know how we would ever change these problems. I remember feeling deep anxiety about what it would mean to leave and not and live off my savings, frankly, and figure out how in the world, what do you do to sort of get people to care about something in a public stage? And there was about a year and a half after that where nothing happened. And it was when I think Trump got elected and the election took place and the conversation started happening about Russian manipulation of the elections. And I had seen certain things like this myself and had been part of a community of researchers who'd been tracking some of those manipulations, that I decided I had to jump in full steam into this problem, even if I didn't know how I would get the attention it deserved. And the real big breakthrough there was the 60 Minutes piece in 2017 called The Addiction Code with Anderson Cooper. And that was the first, I think, major event where insiders from the tech industry were speaking out about it. And that's what led to Sam Harris. And that's what I think helped accelerate this conversation. It was Roger McNamee who wrote the book Zucked. And I did an interview. He was actually the person on Bloomberg hosting. If you don't know, Roger McNamee wrote the book Zucked. He was an early investor
Great
in
book.
Facebook.
Roger is very, very smart. And I admired that book and his work.
Yeah. And he was an early mentor to Mark Zuckerberg in the early days. He actually was brought in, as the opening chapter of the book Zucked says, to sort of convince Mark not to sell the company to, I think it was either Microsoft or Yahoo, and to instead that he had one of the biggest companies in the world on his hands. And so anyway, so Roger felt very similarly, but he was sitting there on the sidelines and hosting this show on Bloomberg TV. And after 60 Minutes, I went on the show and he called me afterwards and said, do you need a wingman? And we set out to try to figure out, how do we start this conversation? And we were at TED together trying to figure out, could we build allies? And honestly, we had almost no one listening or paying attention. People were not really engaged. And it's taken just so long to get the kind of public conversation to match it now.
Yeah, they're paying attention now. So there's Sam Harris, TED. I feel like there was a steady drumbeat of news and awareness. Jaron Lanier is part of this, I believe.
Absolutely.
But I will say that when you sent me a message saying, hey, great news, Netflix documentary, Social Dilemma, like it was still like a pretty big surprise to me. And I know these movies take a while. Yeah. So how the heck did the resources behind the Social Dilemma come about? I feel like there must be some heroic filmmaker we owe a debt to.
Absolutely. So I just want to say also, I was just a, you know, primary subject in the film. We didn't produce the film. I'm not making money from the film. A lot of people think, you know, they accuse this of, I don't even know, trying to make money off of talking about the problem. And this couldn't be farther from the truth. So the film was in the works for about 3 years, starting in 2017. In fact, many of the interviews that are of me in the film were recorded in early 2018, late 2017, I think. So, you know, and they bear relevance to now. And I think it speaks to just how consistently these issues were going to appear in society. The filmmaker, Jeff Orlowski, was actually at Stanford during the same years that I was there. We were both Apple campus representatives, believe it or not. And he had made two award-winning climate change films, one called Chasing Ice and another called Chasing Coral, about, you know, the disappearance of coral and you know, the glaciers up in the northern parts of the world. And we saw this as kind of a climate change of culture piece. He didn't really know about these problems. He'd been following, you know, some of my work, having risen up in 2017. And we started talking about it. We had met the producers, Lori David and Heather Reisman, who we owe just incredible gratitude to, through Arianna Huffington, so who we also owe incredible gratitude to. And this film got off the ground. And it took, like we said, about 3 years for it to come out till now. And, you know, it was really important for us to have it come out before this election, because I think it's possibly most consequential for our democracy. And we talk about a lot of harms, mental health of kids, talk about addiction, but I really think it's the breakdown of our shared information ecology and our ability to trust in shared sources of information and to walk away from, you know, a debate and see the same movie as opposed to different movies. I think this is the most existential aspect that the film really gets at, is our shared reality is being torn apart like a paper shredder into 3 billion narrower and narrower auto-programmed Truman shows, where they are programmed to give us a more affirmation that you're right, the other side is wrong, and here's even more evidence of whichever you believe about controversial polarizing topics. And when you do that and you run that psychology, you know, I think of it like an optometrist who puts this pair of glasses on your eyes, and they put those glasses on us 10 years ago because we started looking out through the glasses of Facebook to see what is the world, what's really going on out there. And we've been wearing these, instead of farsighted or nearsighted glasses, we've been wearing these outrage-sighted glasses for about 10 years now. And again, not just Facebook, but the kind of Twitter, you know, outrage machine, the YouTube outrage machine. And so we're 10 years into this deep psychology experiment that has become the new normal. And we don't, so it's not just about let's fix the platforms now. Let's also, what I hope the film does, is kind of rewind the clock and say, imagine if you wore this hypothetical outrage colored glasses. So you walk into your kitchen and wherever you look, it shows you something you could be outraged at. Like your spouse left the dishes in the sink and it highlights those.
My coffee can wasn't there.
Exactly. Your coffee can is not there and it's not even in the place you usually leave it. The dishes are out. It shows you who left the dishes out. When you look on the refrigerator handle, you see that someone sneezed on it because the glasses highlight the green, you know, microparticles of germs or something. So imagine you were wearing outrage colored glasses everywhere you looked. And imagine you were wearing those glasses for 10 years. How would you feel and think and act and navigate in the world if that was the construction and basis of your reality? And that's exactly what we've had with, I think, these social media platforms. Again, no one at Twitter, we both know Jack, you know, I think intended for any of this to happen. It's just that this became this business model. And once the companies go public, they're forced to be on this treadmill of keeping growth going. And growth is directly connected to time spent and engagement.
Yeah, Jared Lanier, when we talked, he said, well, we looked up and said, seems like advertising is like the best business model we could think of. But then taken to a multi-billion dollar extreme, it ends up having very negative incentives attached, because it's like, okay, now I got to gin up engagement. And how am I going to gin up engagement? By making you outraged at something or afraid or eager to blame someone else. So I agree with your description of the problem, the magnitude of it. Simultaneously to this run-up between 17 and 2020, you also co-founded an organization, the Center for Humane Technology, that's trying to make people more mindful. Can you talk a little bit about what the center's goals are?
Yeah. So the Center for Humane
and Technology. And there's also time well spent. I don't know which one you want to go into.
Well, yeah. So the original work was under the spotlight of an advocacy group called Time Well Spent. And the idea behind this was from a continuity of the first TED Talk that I gave in 2013 or something like that, which was about the idea that we live in a time spent economy, that things are competing for your time. And we obviously, you can always get more money, but you can't get more time. So time is the finite resource that we all share. And it's the ultimate neutral, flat leveling playing field that we all have to operate on. And if you have companies competing for that, you're going to end up with these problems. And we said the answer is, imagine a world where technology competes to help us spend time well. And they're competing on the basis of that finite resource to direct it in the places that we would say align with our own values. That work was important and became, the first stage of all of this, but it didn't capture the vast, like, polarizing conspiracy theories, other kinds of effects that were really at the heart of this. And we needed a new instantiation and a real funded nonprofit vehicle to do this work. So Roger McNamee, Randy Fernando, Aza Raskin, my co-founders of the Center for Humane Technology, put together this group, and we actually partnered with Common Sense Media at the beginning. And Common Sense Media, for those who don't know, is an advocacy organization who focuses on the issues of kids and screen time and privacy-related issues. And we really partnered up to do advocacy in California state legislature. We did a conference in DC called the Truth About Tech Conference. And we've done a bunch of media and started making noise about these problems. And since then, the center is really focused on realigning technology's incentives with humanity's best interests. Simply put, because the fundamental incentives of these large dominant platforms are directly profiting from conspiracy theories, polarization, breakdown of mental health. The more addicted your kids are, the more anxious they are. Not that, again, anyone wants this to happen. The line in the film that I think describes it best, that Justin Rosenstein says, who invented the like button, is, so long as a whale is worth more dead than alive, and a tree is worth more as lumber than as a tree, and we don't regulate private forests or protect, state forests, now we're the whale, we're the tree, we're the resource that is being strip mined into our, our cognition. And that means that we're worth more if we're addicted, distracted, outraged, narcissistic, attention-seeking, polarized, and disinformed than if we're a thriving citizen or a healthy, growing child who's, living their lives in the way that we want. And I think this speaks to some of your work, Andrew, because it's about dignity. It's about, are we the product where we're just a cog in the economy, or do we fundamentally have dignity? And can we have a system that treats each of us with a kind of sacred dignity that it should work that way?
Yeah, it's about, do we work for the economy or does the economy work for us? Are we worth more outrage than calm? It's like, well, maybe I'd still prefer to be calm, even if I'm worth more outraged. We have to see to it that we're not all just instruments of profit and revenue maximization, because it turns out maximizing our profitability is really bad for us. It means that we're very, very pissed off and ready to click and act and watch whatever videos you want to serve to us at any moment in time.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
It's great to give people this sense of what it took to get to this moment, the social dilemma, the fact that now, in large part because of you individually and all the people that have helped you in your work, that the awareness about the nature of these problems is now higher than it's ever been. And if you look at polling around big tech. Big tech has gone from can do no wrong to whoa, like there's some real problems and excesses that we're going to have to figure out and get to the bottom of. You can see that with the recent antitrust hearings and the rest of it, which is one angle. To me, that's like fine, but it's missing some of the fundamental problems. It's like, you know, like pretending these tech companies are, you know, oil companies or steel companies or whatever, it's like not really doing the trick. So this is the big thing I want to pick your brain on. So so full disclosure, because this might entertain you, I would say things on the trail like, hey, quoting you, sometimes I attributed, sometimes I didn't. I knew you wouldn't care. But I would say, we have some of the smartest engineers in the country turning supercomputers into dopamine delivery devices for our kids. And it's having a disastrous effect on our mental health, teenage girls in particular, according to Jonathan Haidt and Gene Twenge's data. And then every parent in Iowa, New Hampshire who heard this were like, yeah, because they see their kids getting addicted to their screens and, you know, it's not great for their development. And then they would turn to me and say, what are we going to do about it? And then I would say, you know what we're going to do? and here's where, I don't know if you said this, I said, as your president, I'm going to start a Department of the Attention Economy, and I'm going to have my friend Tristan Harris run it. Tristan has been trying to change the design decisions of these tech companies for years. Now, most of them, you know, just gave like, Andrew knows someone specifically who, who has the right thinking on this. But if we were to play that scenario out, what do we need to do to try and humanize our technology and our use of it?
First, I just want to say a few things to what you shared. Well, I just want to say I appreciated so much that you, like with universal basic income and like with other aspects of your platform, you, I think, have always prioritized a kind of public education in your work, in trying to help people understand and elevate issues that are not being talked about, and using your presidential campaign to do that. I think that was amazing. You did that with UBI, and you've also been doing that with the attention economy. And, you know, I think you helped make it even a bigger issue. And I just really want to say, I really appreciated that you led the way, on elevating it as I think to its rightful position as one of the top issues facing society, because it's underneath and exacerbating all the other issues.
It makes it impossible to solve any problems if we can't even agree on reality.
Exactly. And that's what we say in the film so clearly, is if we can't agree on reality, we can't solve any problem, whether it's climate change, poverty, or social justice and racism, or whatever we want to deal with. So truth be told, this is not an easy thing to regulate. It has to do with core business models. I do think we can look to ways that the climate movement thinks about an increasing over time tax to carbon, you know, to carbon externality, setting a price on carbon, you know. So essentially, as we've talked about, this is an extractive economy, where instead of extracting oil out of the ground and then producing, you know, climate change at a global level in the commons, depleting the environmental commons and also eroding the life support systems of the planet, that's the fossil fuel economy. In this case, we have an extractive economy built on not just extracting human attention, but as we talked about in an earlier interview we did, fracking for human attention, because we're worth more also when we're multitasking. Really quickly on that, we're worth more when you have a tablet, a phone, and your television up. And that triples the size of the attention economy, because now you're paying attention to three things. So,
dark.
But one thing that very much like that, when you use the metaphor of fracking for attention, you start to see that we're selling, just like the financial crisis, thinner and thinner slices of human attention, as if it's worth the same as valuable concentrated attention, but it's kind of junk attention, just like we're selling thinner and thinner credit default swap type, you know, junk instruments, financial instruments, and selling it as if it's this bigger thing and propping up this kind of inflated advertising attention market. So I think one thing we can do is we can correct for that inflation. You know, I think there's one study from a couple years ago where Facebook was found to inflate the amount of advertising reporting that it did for their advertisers by 900%, meaning they exaggerated how much the viewership or clicks there was by 900%. So that's just like, you know, a financial broker exaggerating the value of, you know, a financial instrument by a lot. So we can kind of clean up comprehensively this systemically fragile, fragility creating system. So much like you want to, you can't just say we're going to get completely off of oil in 1 year and carbon prices are going to be set to $1 million a ton and we're going to move over. You set up a transition plan over 10 years. So I think what we need is a transition plan from each company maximizing how much attention that they kind of extract to winding down how much commodification of human attention that we can do over time. One model of this actually comes from the way that we regulate energy companies, because it used to be that PG&E or Con Edison or whatever your energy company is, they're a for-profit company. Theoretically, they want you to use as much energy as possible. So leave the lights on, leave the faucets on, maximize your just wasting of energy and you're maximizing climate pollution, you know, activity and behavior. They can even put those nests in your home and then maximize how much you use to like manipulate you into using the most. That would be a kind of dystopian reality.
Our recommended home temperature is 95 degrees.
Exactly. And get you to change it all the time. And, you know, anyway, so obviously that would be an extractive kind of business, and it's fundamentally misaligned with the commons because it accelerates climate change, et cetera. So we've dealt with this problem before. We actually have regulated utilities that set seasonal targets for how much money you can make as a utility off of a certain amount of energy. So for example, if there's a seasonal availability of so much energy, it costs this much for this lower tier usage. And then if you're a consumer and you use, let's say, beyond that amount, because it's a hot summer, they actually double charge you for that next phase of energy that you're using, except those extra profits don't go into the coffers of PG&E or Con Edison. They go into a public fund that actually invests in the renewable energy infrastructure that we need. So that's a nice, I don't know if you caught that, but it's a sort of a nice transition plan of...
I caught that.
Yeah. I don't know how I explain these things very well. You probably know these things better than I do, frankly. But
No. So let me just try and walk through this just for fun. So let's say you and I are getting together and we're part of the Department of the Attention Economy and we're like, all right, hey, Facebook, here's the deal. We find you excessively extractive in terms of the amount of attention you're getting from folks. So step number one, stop exaggerating the amount of time we actually spend on you. That's number one. But number two, for every bit of attention you get beyond a certain period, let's call it like hour four plus for a teenager. Like there's actually like some negative social value associated mm-hmm. with that. So we're going to have you pay a penalty and then use that penalty then to fund some alternatives. Let's call it like little leagues or whatever. Like we fund something that would be like the anti Facebook type of countermeasure. Is that more or less accurate?
Well, I also want to say this is a tiny part of a probably a more comprehensive way of dealing with these problems. But I think there's a part of it, which is that we have to remove some of the perverse incentives.
Yes.
What you're saying now reminds me of something I said when I went to the advertising festival, where, you know, we were talking to the advertisers that fund all this activity and these mental health harms and said, you know, after there's a mental health crisis from kids and there's a loneliness crisis, someone's going to ask the question, who paid for all of this to happen? And it's obviously these advertisers. And one of the things we proposed was, imagine you just simply cannot make money from usage between, let's say, midnight and 6 a.m. if you're a tech company. That disincentivizes usage of sort of late night lonely use. That's sort of the low willpower period of use. Now that's definitely,
I don't know what you're talking about, Tristan. I have never done any low willpower to tech social media use between those hours.
I think you are the superhuman willpower one among us that is
kidding. We've all done it, but I love that idea so much, where you cordon off a number of hours where you're like, look, extracting attention in these hours is not a good thing.
It's like treating a park, you know, those trees. Some of the trees we extract and we turn into lumber. Other trees we say, this is part of a national park and they're for walking and exploring and enjoying, right? And it's like some of our attention can be maybe, you know, part of a system that obviously wants to commoditize it. But that's another thing, is there sort of a violation of turning alive humanness and alive human choice into these dead slabs of human behavior through behavior modification engines, right? So we turn like a live consciousness into this sort of deadened consciousness in which your behavior is more or less predictable because we've taken what could be a free choice and turned it into an unconscious habit, which is a form of kind of like dead lumber is to a tree, what dead, you know, human behavior is to a live human being. There's many different aspects of this that I think we have to correct. I think what we need here is overall something more comprehensive. Just like with the financial crisis, if you asked me, Andrew, and said, what's the one law that we pass that's going to fix all this? I like your approach that this is sort of an ongoing issue and that we need a cabinet level department of the attention economy to deal with these problems.
Well, let's dig into the toolkit a little bit more because I'm already learning a ton from you. So I love seeing it as something of a negative externality, like attention beyond a certain point where you say, look, like I was thinking beyond hour X is probably not a great thing for you. I love your saying, look, between midnight and 6 a.m., probably terrible for teenagers to be Facebooking it up or whatnot. Like, just throw a few things out there like that also belong somewhere in like the consideration set or toolkit.
Yeah, you know, we're going to be publishing some more on this on our website soon. I have some of it up here right now, but I think a more comprehensive approach is something like what we had for the financial crisis, where we had a comprehensively risk-creating system, and we needed comprehensive Basel III reforms in Europe or the Dodd-Frank kind of reforms in the United States. I know there's some problems with that, but that's thematically what we would want to be going after. So we need protection for kids, privacy for people, transparency for platforms. You could imagine you get Section 230 protections for content, but not for amplification or recommendation systems. And in exchange for getting Section 230 protections, for those who don't know, it's what enables platforms to not be liable for bad content on their platforms. But in exchange for that, there has to be transparency to the public and to many civil society groups to be able to say which things we want to measure about the use or prevalence of certain kinds of content so that we can actually do a better job of regulating them, because we don't even have transparency now about how bad is the teenage mental health problem. How many users beneath the age of 16 are using it between 2 and 4 in the morning? If we had transparency, we could actually make them report not to a board of directors, but to a board of the people based on these metrics that matter to us in a democratically governed society.
Oh, that is enormous. So modifying Section 230 in those ways would be huge, because in many ways, that is these companies' license to operate and print money, really.
That's right.
You know, and this was written in 96 before any of these companies even existed. Like, we couldn't
so
have
I'm sure they anticipated YouTube and Facebook and TikTok, you know, many years later.
Yeah, so we need to examine this license, essentially. And what you're suggesting is a difference between posting content and then spreading advertising content or messages or videos that there's some kind of commercial incentive attached to. So that's a very interesting distinction. The other interesting thing you're attaching to it is to say, look, we're going to give you this. And in some cases, this franchise is worth, you know, billions, even trillions of dollars. But in return, we get data. They get real data about what the actual public harms are. Because if you compare this to a negative externality where you look at, you know, for example, with pollution, you look around and say, okay, there's there are negative effects through climate change. In this one, we actually need the data that the social media companies have in order to measure a lot of the harms.
That's right. And so this is table stakes. This is not the thing that answers the problems. This is the sort of prerequisite for being able to do anything. A metaphor I often have, Anderson, since you're using these climate change analogies, is it's like Facebook is like Exxon, but they're the Exxon of human anxiety, except they also don't just own the kind of, you know, extraction of oil. They also own the entire satellite network that we have to observe and measure how much CO2 and methane. So they actually control the measurement of how bad the problem is. So this is ridiculous. It's almost like, it's, you know, if you take the monopoly conversation, it's a vertically integrated company that owns both the measurement, you know, either the exclusive access to measurement of the harm and also the harm creation. That's a vertically integrated, perverse sort of company. There's also other aspects: freedom from manipulation, accountability for harms, enabling more competition. We can dig into that because it's less about, as you said, magically breaking them up causes the removal of misinformation or addiction in society, because you still have a race to the bottom to create those problems. And then also national security, because we haven't talked about that. That, you know, while we've been obsessed, you know, by some folks and politicians of protecting our physical borders, we've been leaving our digital borders wide open. And this is really important because if Russia or China try to fly a plane into the physical United States or they try to get across the passport controls, we have huge billions of dollars invested in either shooting down that plane or stopping them at the border. But as soon
and as none of us would accept it. None of us would accept the fact that you have 70 countries right now that are investing in misinformation, and everyone's like, oh, you know, if you had 70 countries flying planes through our airspace, we'd all be like, what the heck is going on?
That's exactly right. And so, if you think about it, as how much of the surface area of our country's activity happens in the physical world, and how much of that surface area is moving into the virtual world of kind of Facebook, Instagram, clicks, advertising, email, etc. And more of our economic activity is moving from the physical to the digital, but we don't protect the digital borders. So if Russia and China try to fly an information plane into the virtual United States, instead of being met by the Pentagon to shoot it down, they're met by a Facebook algorithm with a white glove that says, yeah, exactly which zip code or minority group would you like to target with more divisive information that could stir up culture wars. So this is an urgent national security threat that we've been meaning to try to get, you know, more into the agenda, because I think we massively underestimate the vulnerability of culture. You know, after World War II, you know, big powers like Russia, China, Iran, Turkey, they're not going to, attack the United States with nuclear weapons anymore. They can't do kinetic warfare. And so what would you do? You would actually want to take the divisions in a country that already exist, walk over their virtual borders, and stir up culture wars and racial divides everywhere, which is exactly what we're seeing them doing. We also know that Russia has gone after ex-U.S. veteran groups and trying to sow more discontent about, you know, the military.
Oh, it's so dark.
We know that Russia is going after environmentalist groups. In fact, they actually go after pro-environmentalist, anti-fracking U.S. advocates like Greenpeace and amplify them, because what happens if in the U.S. we don't frack? We have to buy more foreign oil from where? From Russia. So there's many different aspects to this problem, but I think what people need to know is that this is in all of our interests. It's not a partisan issue. It's really a global issue and a national security issue that affects everyone.
So Tristan, if hypothetically I am part of the administration and I call you and say, hey, do you want to join the newly christened Department of the Attention Economy and clean this stuff up? Like, are you game? Are we going to do this thing?
If we can make that happen and there's a real opportunity in the next administration, I think I would have to strongly consider doing that.
Well, Tristan, you're a blessing to us all. The fact that you've been fighting this fight sometimes in relative pain and obscurity, and now this is a moment when everyone can look at you and say, he's been onto something this whole time, just like your old colleagues at Google who are like, hey, I didn't see it, but now I see it. We all see it now, which is the first big step towards solving a problem, is acknowledging its existence. And now we have to solve it as quickly as possible because time is not on our side. And this stuff's getting nastier, more virulent. It's going to make it impossible for us to. This is the problem that if you don't solve it, you can't solve anything else.
That's right. But I do think the thing that gives me hope, Andrew, is that, you know, what's been missing is the collective will of the people and public pressure. And I wish I could show the world my inbox, because I didn't even have an Instagram account that I hadn't used since 2012. And now suddenly I went from, you know, no followers or whatever to something like 50,000. I get messages from all around the world from people saying, I'm ready to do everything I can. This is too important. Everyone wants to solve this problem. So I probably feel like you did, where you're just getting messages from people around the country saying, we got to solve it. And I know that's not enough. We have to actually translate it into meaningful action and political energy. But I think that the difference between this and climate change is, unlike seeing the movie Inconvenient Truth and then saying, well, this is going to happen to my grandkids, if this is the climate change of culture and it's sort of a disaster for our social fabric, after seeing the movie, you turn to that glass slab in your pocket and you stare at it 80 more times that day. And you know that it's causing these problems. So I think that this really is the issue we can all unite around. And that gives me an incredible hope. And I think, as you said, you know, awareness precedes the opportunity for choice. I think the question everyone can ask themselves is, instead of my attention being the commodity, we can also ask what is worth our attention individually, and also what is worth our attention as a country? Because I think the current attention economy does not reflect, you know, what really matters to us.
None of us would choose this, that's for sure, Tristan. And we're going to have to actually decide what to choose if we give ourselves that chance. So pumped to reconnect with you. Congratulations on your organization and movement and documentary getting to this point. And I'm thrilled to work with you because we got to solve these problems. I do get those messages, and I appreciate the Yang Gang and the love so much. We should maybe give a name for your gang.
We do need one, actually. I don't know if it's the Humane Gang.
Yeah, Humane Gang, Gang of Humans, whatever it is. But the challenge now, just to give you at least my sense of things, is what you just said is like, look, you're the people, then you have this political energy, and then you have a political system that is not exactly super high functioning. and that's the thing. And then you have, in your case, you have these $650 billion companies or multi-billion dollar companies who are like the biggest, richest. They're like almost countries unto themselves. And when they look up and see our national government, they do not think to themselves these people know what's best for me and my business. Like I should really listen to them. it's more like this is like the popular energy is an enormous first step, but activating our political machinery to actually like make these changes and bring some of these companies to the table, popular zeal will help because a lot of the folks work at these companies like you did. A lot of the folks obviously, have kids themselves or use the services. But the real fight is coming.
Yeah. Well, I think we actually have a lot of lessons to learn from probably people who used to formerly work for you, because we do need to build a movement on the back of, I think, what the film is creating. I think there's so much energy to change, but we have to channel it in the appropriate directions. And I know there's some things coming up locally in California, the Consumer Privacy Act, Consumer Privacy Reform Rights Act, excuse me. And some more action in Europe, but I want to encourage people to really get involved, to educate yourself. We do have more resources on humanetech.com. But honestly, Andrew, I'd love to learn more as well about how do we activate a movement around this, because it is how we see it. I think we have to organize a constituency that this is the issue that's beneath other issues.
Well, you and I are going to connect. I'm going to text you, and I want to be a resource to you in any way I can. If someone does want to get energized around your movement, is humanetech.com the best place to go?
Yeah, the best place to go is humanetech.com. For those who want to know just how they take control of the things and the effects that they saw in the film, there's a take control page. We also have a great podcast called Your Undivided Attention, where we interview many of the people who are in the film, The Social Dilemma, but go in depth on YouTube recommendations, go in depth on Russian disinformation, go in depth on the casino-like slot machine design of social media. And that's a good place to educate yourself. And we're really working now on kind of mobilization. So how do we build those catchment systems that mobilize people? And I would, frankly, Andrew, I would really love to follow up with you about how you did that and who we could leverage from your movement to help us. Because I think we can really get a large constituency that's also bipartisan too.
Done and done. We are at your disposal. Let's give it up for Tristan Harris. Tristan, thank you so much, brother.
It's such a pleasure to be here, Andrew. I really, really appreciate what you've done. And I'm really excited to follow up. I really think this is so important. So thank you so much for having me on.
Me too.